This is our 2008 West Coast School of the Prophets. The theme for the weekend, How to Master the Secrets of Bible Study. Our speaker has been Brother Roger Lewis from the Christ Church North Ecclesia in New Zealand. This is session 9, How to Manage Time and Set Effective Spiritual Goals. Brother Roger.
Well, I'm sorry we're late this morning. I ran out of time to complete my session on how to manage time. So, bit of a paradox there, isn't there? This morning, what I thought we would do is start off as we should always start, and that's to begin with a biblical imperative on the matter. And once we've considered a biblical basis for our thinking, then I'm going to put some things up on the board which I think might be helpful in terms of some basic time management skills which you can take away and apply basically in your life. It could be used in business, it could be used for personal organisation, and it can certainly be used for spiritual organisation. And these are not my ideas, they're common ideas out there used by many people. So if you come to the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 3, just some opening thoughts then with regard to the matter of time as the Bible expresses it to us. And perhaps this is the most famous, of course, of all the passages on the subject of time. And in fact, what we're being told is this. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, it says in verse 1, "To everything there is a season, and a time for every purpose under heaven." So what we're being told is that time as a concept encompasses man's entire environment. Everything we do is caught within the scope of what's called the principle of time. To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. And so we know this famous set of words, a time to be born and a time to die. And as this sequence of events of times is unfolded in Ecclesiastes, if Solomon was the author of Ecclesiastes, which I think he was, then he would be aware of all of these times as a king. Not only in the execution of his own responsibilities as king, he would need to learn that there was a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones. He would know that there was a time for war and a time for peace. Kings needed to know that. But he would also know it in the context of all of the various experiences of his people. His people were going through a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. And so I guess that as we go through this story, what happens, of course, is that finally we end up with what we hope and what we believe is the ultimate time, which at the end of verse 8 is, lastly, a time of shalom, a time of peace, a time of fellowship, a time of unity, when everything is resolved, finally, in the purpose of God. In the meantime, though, we're all on this journey of time, and we're caught within the constraints of what that means. So as Ecclesiastes verses chapter 3 verses 1 to 8 unfolds this sequence of events, not only are there opposites, a time to be born and a time to plant and a time to pluck up, but in effect what we're being told is that therefore there are right times and wrong times for things. If there is a time to keep and a time to cast away, then part of the wisdom of what we must learn is what to do at what time. So learning to do the right thing at the right time is a critical thing in the circumstances of our life and in the wise organisation of our life and, by the way, of ecclesial life. Because sometimes something crops up in ecclesial life and you think, "Ooh, I'd like to do something about that right now. I'm not happy with that." Well, you might not be happy, but is it the right time? Is it the right circumstance? A wise man learns not only what is the right issue, but when will be the right time to deal with that issue. And the right time may not always be right now. So as the story unfolds, the record goes on to say after that sequence of times, opposites, negatives and positives, is that verse 9 says, what profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboureth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised by it. And so what happens, and what we believe, is that time in the end basically imposes a constraint on all of our endeavours in life, because time is something over which we ourselves have no control. Time itself is beyond our control. We can't control time. And yet the funny thing is this, verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in his time. God's organized time. In fact, the Jerusalem Bible says he's made everything apt in his time. Everything suitable and appropriate according to the timetable of the Father himself. Because after all, time is under the control of the Father. And also, verse 11, he has set the world in their heart. Now, does anyone know what the word world is and what the word world means here? Yes, it's the word olam, isn't it? He has set the olam in their heart. So there's a strange paradox here. Man finds that his life is governed by the constraints of time that will ultimately cause him to die. He's only got limited time. And yet somehow planted deep within a man is the yearning for timelessness. Man has a yearning for that which is everlasting, that which is eternal. Man has always sought for immortality, hasn't he? Why did the Egyptians build pyramids? Because they wanted to believe there was an afterlife, that men lived on, that men could break free from the shackles of time. So down through the ages, there has always been a yearning inside men for that which relates to the eternal, the everlasting, the principles of the olam. And God has set that in the heart of man so that he might seek out how that might of course occur. And of course the answer lies in coming to the Father, who is the ultimate controller of time. But it's what man finds is that there is a conflict between his aspirations in his larger vision and the actual finite constraints of the time of his life. Man finds that all of life's experiences are governed by time, and God controls it, not him. And so verse 13 goes on to say that as a result of that, maybe verse 12, I know that there is no good in them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labour. It's the gift of God. So we need to realise that we can't struggle against time's limitations. We've got to accept that we're governed by that and learn to work wisely within the constraints of time that are available to us. If we're trapped by the cycles of time and God controls those and not us, and those time cycles regulate our every activity, then what we must do is learn to operate within that and to know how to enjoy our labours as the gift of God. Mind you, he says, verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. God requireth that which is past. So what verse 15 is telling us is that God is not limited by time. He can instantly recall the past or travel forward into the future. Excuse me. Now this is something we have a problem with, isn't it? How can God recall the past and know the future? And the answer is, of course, because he lives in a different dimension of time to us, which opens up all sorts of possibilities as to how life works in the future, and are we able to travel through time as well as through space? Because all these ideas are related, that maybe that's how the angels travel, that the angels don't just travel physically, but they travel through time, that an angel could appear or disappear because it's actually they've changed time dimensions. We don't know how all of this actually works. You may know, I don't know if any of you have studied black holes. Anyone know what a black hole is? What's a black hole? Yeah, it's a star that's collapsed and it's now sucking all energy, including light, into itself. Well, what they say is that when you get to the edge of a black hole, because it's sort of like a plug hole, it's so powerful that it can suck even light into it. Isn't that an interesting idea? On the perimeter of the black hole, as everything goes, time actually stands still for a moment. It actually warps time. A black hole warps time. It stretches time and then compresses time. So we don't understand how all of this works, but the Father does. The Father does. And the Father is therefore able to know the past and the future and the present because he operates in a different dimension of time to us. These are all parts of the things that we yearn to understand, but it's not for the present, not for now. So in effect, what God says is, for right now, you've got to learn that you've got a beginning of time and an end of time. And within the scope of that time, you've got to do everything that needs to be done to prepare for the kingdom and have your character shaped and fashioned as far as the Father is concerned to be prepared for that future time. Whatever lies beyond that, the Father will in his good wisdom reveal to us at the appropriate time. But for now, we realize that time is actually ticking away. That our greatest problem is that we can't control time, we can't stop time. Time relentlessly ticks away. I've always found those hourglasses to be spooky things. Have you ever seen a big hourglass? You put it on the table and you watch fascinatedly as the sand goes shh, and you suddenly think, that sand represents an hour. And it trickles away and trickles away and trickles away, and all of a sudden it's gone. You turn it over and you start another hour, but that past hour's gone for good. It can never be recovered. It's forever gone. It's disappeared permanently. It's irrecoverable. And you suddenly realize that our lives, unfortunately, are trickling away like sand, relentlessly. And if we don't do something about it, all the sand will be gone soon. So coming to the New Testament, you remember there was a famous passage in the book of Ephesians where Paul made a comment on that. And he just said this one thing, didn't he, in Ephesians chapter 5. And there's a similar statement in Colossians, which is of course the companion epistle. But he says this in Ephesians chapter 5, and verse 14, wherefore he saith, awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. Seeing then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Redeeming the time, because the days are evil. And Colossians 4 says somewhat the same thing, walk in wisdom toward them that are without, redeeming the time. Now we can't redeem time in the literal sense of the word. We can't redeem time that's already gone. So what does Paul mean when he says redeeming the time? What do you think he means? Make the most of it, in a sense. Redeem what you can by using the time that we do have as effectively and as efficiently as possible. One of the problems when we're young, of course, is we do think that we're immortal. You know, bullets can't hit us. Nothing can hit us. We're immortal. We're young. And when we're 20, we somehow imagine that life stretches away into the distant future and there's lots of time to do anything we want to do. But the funny thing is this, and I've told lots of teenage groups this. You're a bit older, but most of you are already into the reality of this. But I've spoken to many teenage groups and said, look, I'll tell you that what happens. You get married at 20, you blink and you're 40. It's true. You blink again, you're 60. It's dangerous. Don't blink. And time moves much more quickly than we realize. And the older we get, the more we realize that time has gone faster than we thought. We never thought that at 20. At 40 we do. At 60 we're certain of it. At 80 we're thankful for whatever time we've got left. Jimmy?
This word redeeming, does it have the idea of buying back or investing time?
I believe so. Yeah.
Buying up the opportunity?
Yeah, that's the Greek word? Yeah. So what we want to talk about now is just this. In effect, what Ecclesiastes says is, you're bound by the constraints of time. You can't control time. God controls time, not you. He's timeless. You're time bound. There's a whole set of things that you'll need to learn the right time and the wrong time. But within the scope of your lifetime, you've got to do what you can to use your time resources as prudently as possible. So Paul says, well, the best way to do that is to buy it up. And how does he mean by buying it up? Well, he means, in effect, to use what you do have as a time resource as efficiently as possible. And one thing I think we need to do is to really grip hold of that, because we don't have as much time as we thought. Now, what I'm going to show you now is not from the Bible. It's strictly from the world, in the sense that it's a time management set of questions. However, I've used these questions for myself, and I found them very helpful. The reason why I found them helpful is because they really started to focus my thinking on what I needed to do. And bear in mind that this is a person in the world who doesn't understand the truth and isn't asking these questions from the perspective of the truth. But we can take these sorts of things and say, well, let's put the overlay of the truth on them and apply them now within the context of our life. But this is what he said. And I think they're quite useful. The point of these questions was to make you focus on what is really important in your life. So this is what he said to an audience. He said, here's some questions. The first thing is, what would I do if I won $10 million in cash right now? So in other words, would you stay with your current job? Would you give it up? What would you do if you didn't need to have that job? If you had so much money in the bank that you knew you could live adequately for the rest of your life, would you do the job you've got now? Yes or no? And if you wouldn't do that job, what would you be doing? So try and picture it that way. I've got $10 million in the bank. What would I be doing right now? And as a result of that, you start to think about, well, yes, what would I be doing? We've got to start getting this clear and writing it down. The second thing is, and this is a different part to the same question, what would I do differently if I only had 6 months to live? So the doctor calls you in, he says, I've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that you're going to be dead in 6 months. You've got a very rare disease that's going to actually cause your heart to rupture in about 6 months' time. I don't know the exact time, but it's just going to stop. It's just going to go boom, finish. The funny thing is that for that 6 months, you're going to feel terrific. You're going to feel absolutely bursting with energy. But when it comes, I'm sorry, it's all over. Now the question is, if you knew that you only had 6 months to live, what would you do? What would you do with your life? And how would that relate to the first question? If you had enough money in the bank to do whatever you wanted to do, but you knew you only had 6 months left to do it, would that change what you would answer under the first question? Or would it be somewhat the same? The next question is, what do I really love to do that gives me satisfaction and pleasure? Remember, this is a humanistic thing. But what do I really love to do that gives me satisfaction and pleasure? Because sometimes people find that they're doing lots of things, including their career, which they're busy at, which they don't actually really enjoy at all. I think it was Stephen Covey that said that when you're scrambling up the ladder of success, just make sure it's leaning against the right building. Some people end up working really hard at things that they, if they're really honest about, they don't actually even like. Sometimes we don't have the ability or the privilege to be able to change our employment, but the focus of this is, well, what actually is important to you? Next question, and you've heard this one before. You go to a funeral, and there are people coming up the front to actually talk about the dear departed deceased. And they talk about what this person was like and what that person meant to them. And you suddenly realise, with shock, that they're talking about you and it's actually your funeral. So this involves obviously some doctrinal inconsistencies. that you'd be able to actually attend and view your own funeral. So we won't go into that because I'm just repeating what was said in this particular seminar that I went to. But for purposes of analogy, the question that he asked was, so if they were up the front talking about you and it was your funeral, what would you want them to say about you? What would you want them to say that you stood for as a person? What would you want them to say that you represented as a person? What would you want them to say was the overriding impression of who you were? And what are you doing in your life now to be that person that you'd like them to talk about? Or you're doing something completely different? And then moving on to that, what are the five most important values in my life? What are the things that I would never be prepared to compromise on? Even companies use this. They use a core value strategy that says, what are our deepest core values that are so important that we'd be prepared to actually walk away from the company if those values were compromised? What are they? They represent the heart and soul of the company. If those values are not upheld, this company has no reason for existence. Well, this happens in personal life as well. Now, the fact is that even from a biblical perspective, there's a whole set of values that we may have, but what are the critical ones? What are the important values that you hold to, that I hold to? And then this area here is very helpful because now he comes down to the principle of goal setting. And what he said was, well, let's start with the top seven areas. What are the top seven goals in all major areas of my life? And by the way, basically what they do is they say, well, you should think of physical, spiritual, financial, family, personal, community, creative. So all the different aspects of a person's life. What's the seven most important goals, the seven top goals in all major areas of your life? And then if you had those seven and were only allowed of those three, what would you shrink it down to in terms of the three greatest goals of your life? And if you only had one of those, the question that you would ask for the bottom is, what's the one goal that will have the greatest effect on progressing all the others? Now, the interesting thing about this is that all these questions change as our life changes and as we grow. But the point I'm making about this is that I think that even Christadelphians need to have goals. And I think far too many Christadelphians don't have goals. They have no goals and no objectives in life, and I think we should. And we certainly should have spiritual goals. So what are they? Have we got them down? Have we got them clear? Have we written them down? And by the way, one of the critical things with this is that this is an exercise that you need to write down. You've got to write it down, write it down, write it down, and think about it. Write what you think is the answer to those questions. Now, bear in mind, as I said at the start, this is a Gentile publication. What degree of this applies to the truth is for each person to decide. But my personal view is that having some idea of how to set some priorities in your life is very valuable, in fact, for all of us. Because if we were to honestly go through even those questions and ask ourselves what our answers would be, you would have made a huge progression in terms of where you are from now, in terms of your clarity of mind. If you're going to redeem the time, you need to know what you want to do, what you want to achieve, where you're heading, what needs to be accomplished. Well, how can you do any of that if you've never thought about any of this? So there's a sequence of events here that needs to happen. Yes.
Did you go through this list with your wife? Because I can imagine that when you're setting goals, that if as marriage partners you don't have those in common, then that's going to lead to conflict.
I think that that's the next stage. So I think that you started off personally, but when you get to the stage of marriage, obviously marriage partners must have goals that they share in common. Not all of them, by the way, because you may have some personal goals that are not in conflict with your marriage, because it might relate to you as a man, for example. But they've got to be integrated with your marriage. So you're quite right. You don't want a set of goals that lead you off in a different direction to your marriage partner because you haven't consulted and you find that she's got her goals and you've got yours and we're back to postmodernism again. and the marriage collapses because they're both busy pursuing their own goals. So you're quite right. There's another overlay beyond this that says, well, okay, those are mine. I'd like to talk to my spouse about this and share with her what her goals are, and then see what our personal goals are on a marriage basis for our marriage and for our family. But the whole idea about this process of goal setting is it really sharpens our focus as to how we might need to use our time in order to move those objectives forward in life. So obviously this is something that you can't do, you know, overnight, but as you start to write things down, and I've done that exercise, by the way, I've worked through all of that, and I've worked through my top 7 goals, my top 3 goals, my top 1 goal, and one of the things they say about that is this, and you may have heard of this. There was a study done, there's 2 conflicting reports on whether the study was done through Harvard or done through Yale. But it doesn't really matter. Let's say it was Harvard. There was a study done in Harvard in 1973 from the departing graduating class of Harvard. So we're talking about people who are, shall we say, they're smart. And what they were asked was, do you have any goals for your life and career now that you've graduated from Harvard moving forward? Now, the interesting thing about that was that they asked, in fact, a series of questions. The questions were, A, do you have any goals? Hands up. B, do you have written goals? And C, do you have written goals with timetables attached to them? So these are the 3 stages. Do you have got any goals at all? Have you ever thought about any goals? Number 2, have you written your goals down? And number 3, have you got dates attached to those goals in terms of a time objective linked to them? Now, I don't know if you know the stats, but the stats are that less than 10% of the population out of Harvard or Yale or anywhere else have any goals in life that they can tell you. That's interesting, isn't it? Less than 10% of the population have any goals at all that they can tell you they have in their life. So people aren't very goal-orientated in that sense. When they came back 20 years later, they reviewed the same graduate class and they assessed their financial position 20 years later. Guess what the results were? Only 3% of the class in 1973 had written goals. 3% had written goals. 10% had goals, 3% had written goals. 3% is not a lot, is it? That 3% who had written goals earned more income and had more assets than the other 97% combined. They earned more income and had more assets than the other 97% combined. Do you think that's because those 3% were brighter, smarter, quicker? I don't think so. The only difference was they had clear goals and they were written down. And that gave them a focus in life that meant that they did one thing far more efficiently than anyone else. And what was that? They used their time better, much better. It wasn't because they were any more talented. Of the 3% that had written goals, only 1% had dates attached to the goals. Here's the next interesting thing about this type of exercise. A person stood at a seminar and said, I want you to write down 5 goals for the next 12 months. Just the next 12 months. Write down 5 goals that you've got for the next 12 months. Now, put them in an envelope, fold them up, put them in an envelope, put the envelope in your drawer. Put a note on your diary to open the envelope in 12 months' time. And what people found was that it was absolutely amazing, but that sometimes five of the goals out of 5 had all been accomplished in 12 months' time. And frequently, they weren't even conscious. They opened the envelope and thought, actually, I've done that. I'd forgotten about that. Oh, that's been done. And they suddenly realized that those goals were being accomplished because it was there in the subconscious as well. Now, that happened when a person wrote down goals once, put them on an envelope, and put them away for 12 months. Imagine what would happen if you wrote your goals down on a more regular basis. Imagine if you wrote your goals down every morning. Before you started the day. What do you think that would do to your focus? Now, to me, this is all about efficient use of time. And why I think that this is really important is because of the next bit which I'm going to come to, which is now sort of some time management skills. And I personally have found these extremely helpful because I believe that this is what all time successful people do. So by time successful, I'm not defining that they're successful in terms of business or career, but that they're certainly successful in terms of the wise use of time. And I think that critical to that is that these people have done this part first. They've figured out their goals. So here's the next section then, in terms of some time management suggestions. Well, here they are. That really does annoy me. I don't know quite how you sort of make that go. Right, here we go. I'm a strong believer in to-do lists. Hands up those that have to-do lists. Very good, very good. Go to the top of the class. I'm a really strong believer in to-do lists, both for work and for personal and for spiritual, because it's the only way to make stuff happen. So here's some tips for operating to-do lists, and it relates to that previous section of having goals. You need to prepare your to-do list for the next day before you finish work. So that means that if you work till 5 o'clock, then at quarter to five or 20 to five, you need to stop what you're doing and write down the to-do list of activities for the next day. So while you're focused on what's been happening this day, you write your to-do list down. Of course, what happens is you come to your to-do list from today, and you think, well, that's done, and that's done, and that's done, and that's done. There's three things that haven't been done. Those three things come up, out, and onto the next to-do list for the next day. They get carried forward, and yesterday's to-do list gets thrown away, and you write it out fresh. Write it fresh. You've got to start fresh. So those items get carried forward. But the critical thing is that you've done this before you go home. Do you know why? Because what happens if you don't do that? All night you think, oh, I must remember to do that tomorrow morning. Oh, I mustn't forget to ring Bob, and I've got to send that document. So, well, you won't do that if you wrote your to-do list for tomorrow down before you leave work today. It's sort of done. You've cleared the clutter of your mind. You've got it all down on paper. I've got to do this, 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 I've got to do this. All right, get it down on paper. So there's a real benefit in writing to-do lists. And one of the reasons why writing to-do lists is helpful in terms of managing time is Christadelphians tend to be busy people. Do you know why? Christadelphians lead double lives. I don't mean lives of double values or double principles, but they lead double lives. We run a full-time job and then we come home and have a full-time life in ecclesial life. I ran for many years where I actually worked at work. I went to work at 8 o'clock, I came home at 6, we had the evening meal, we had stuff at home, I then went back to work or did study, and I studied normally from 12 through to 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I went to bed. Went to bed at 4, by 8 o'clock I was up and off to work the next day. And you lead double lives because you're so busy in the truth, but I had a full-time job because I was self-employed, and self-employed people don't have the luxury of walking away whenever they want to because self-employment doesn't work like that. So what happens is you're inundated with stuff to do everywhere. Now the benefit of writing to-do lists is, what do you think one of the greatest benefits of writing to-do lists is? Well, it's this, that the moment it's down on paper, you almost feel your body going, because now at least it's there, it won't be forgotten, it's in the system, and there is a sense of control to the chaos that otherwise prevails. If you're trying to run a to-do list out of your head, you're going to have problems. The moment it's down on paper, you think, well, I can start to manage this in some way. So starting to learn how to do to-do lists is very helpful because it does bring a sense of control and a greater sense of peace. And Christadelphians even can get very agitated about what they've got to do. This is not a stress that Christadelphians are immune from, because our lives are busier than most people's. Here's the next thing. Write down everything you plan to do in the day. Absolutely everything. Doesn't matter how long the list is, you've got to get it down. Because the moment you get it down, you think, okay, I know where I'm going. It's a long list, but at least I've got everything down. I haven't lost anything. It's under control from that point of view. So write it all down. Get it all down. Every single thing that you plan to do in the course of a day. Now, by the way, I run a to-do list for work, and I run a to-do list for the truth. I run two diary systems on two computers that sit side by side on my desk. I've got a spiritual diary and a spiritual calendar with all of my ecclesial and personal spiritual and family objectives. And I've got my work diary with my whole work schedule there, because I don't actually integrate the two, at least not at the moment. One day I might. I use Apple, and I love the Apple Diary system. Do you know why I like the Apple Diary system? Because the Apple Diary system allows me to put multiple calendars over the top of each other. Who uses Apple here? When you've got the Apple Diary, so if you imagine your Microsoft calendar, you can put in a whole lot of things. And so you can say, well, that's all to do with my job. And then you click a button, you call up another calendar, and now the calendar goes blank. You can click the old one off, click the new one on. Now you can put all your ecclesial duties in. Then you can click that one off. Then you can click a new one on that says, this is my spiritual study program. You can put that on. Then you can click that off and say, these are my family responsibilities in terms of connections with my family. And now you can then click all of them back on, and they all go bloop, and there's the whole diary with everything integrated, your spiritual activities, your work activities, your family time, all integrated over the top of each other. So you can flick them all off and have just the one, or you can put them all on as overlays over the top of one another so you can see the totality of everything that's going on in your life. So I like that. I find that helpful. And of course, also by doing that, you can see what conflicts there are and what you can do and can't do in terms of time commitments, in terms of agreeing to have a committee meeting or whatever. You say, well, actually, I can't do that because that's my granddaughter's birthday and I'm not going to a committee meeting that night, because I've got a family calendar that says that's not possible. So write down everything you plan to do in the day. Here's the next thing. You've got to differentiate between urgent and important. Now, I don't know if any of you have read Stephen Covey on 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Stephen Covey talks about the difference between urgent and important. He actually talks about the 4 quadrants. Anyone heard of the 4 quadrants before? Okay, can you tell me what the 4 quadrants are?
One would be something that's a crisis that suddenly comes up, like you have a splitting toothache that has to be dealt with, like you really.
Yep. So you've got sort of like, you've got a... Okay, just give me those again, because you've got them right. So just give me them again.
You have urgent and important, urgent and important, urgent and not important.
Okay. So you've got, I have to put this one up first, because I know which one this is. This is important, but not urgent.
Correct.
This is not important. And not urgent. Which is quadrant 4. So if that's correct, what would these two be? This is urgent but not important. And so by logical deduction, what's this one? It's what? It's urgent and important. Now, the idea behind this is that you need to learn how to operate these quadrants. Because if you look at those quadrants, what happens is that most people live in quadrant 1. You arrive in the morning and you turn on your email. There are 97 emails for your careful consideration, every one of which demands an urgent response, preferably yesterday if possible. So now what are you going to do? And that's urgent. And also there's four voicemail messages, and there's three pieces of paper on your desk. Could you please ring the following people urgently? So most days start like this. It's a really fun time of the day. And these are urgent but not important things. They're sort of like what I'd call bushfires in business. Then there are number three, quadrant three, urgent and important things, and they really do have to be dealt with because, well, they're both urgent and important. But the critical quadrant to learn to operate in is quadrant number two, which is, it's important, but it's not urgent. Now, let me give you an illustration of sort of how that works. Something in quadrant two that's important but not urgent would be something like, let's say there's been lots of problems with clients complaining about, in my business I'm in financial advisory, about what we say in our reports, how we report on their portfolios. We're getting a raft of calls of people that can't understand it, and month after month this is happening, so we're getting a lot of stuff in quadrant one. We're getting little bushfires to put out. Now I can keep putting out bushfires in quadrant one and handling phone calls, but what do I really need to do? I need to solve the problem with our reporting by means of a programming change to the reports so that clients don't have this misunderstanding problem that they keep on having. So I've got to spend some time in quadrant two to actually rewrite the program. It's not sitting on my diary as being urgent right now, but it's an important thing for the long-term benefit of the company. Now the funny thing is, if I can get into quadrant two and do that and reprogram the reporting system so that it changes how it reports, what's going to happen back in quadrant one once I've done that? Quadrant one's going to shrink in terms of those people that were ringing up and complaining about that. So I'm going to actually release the pressure of quadrant one back off me, because those bushfires won't be starting. Now what happens is most people live life in quadrant one and quadrant two, and in the end they can't cope and they burn out, so they go to quadrant four. And they end up playing solitaire on their computer, or going and have some more coffees, or reading the newspaper, because they actually are so overloaded with stress that they just can't cope any longer, and so they disappear off to quadrant four and they do stuff that's actually a complete waste of time, but it's just they couldn't cope with anything else. So when we talk about to-do lists, differentiating between urgent and important is to learn that difference between what's time urgent in terms of other people and what's really important in terms of your business moving forward. The more important stuff you can do, the more you'll actually get rid of this stuff. So you need to differentiate. So why that's important is that when you write down your to-do list each day, you're going to say, okay, now I've got this big to-do list. I know now, by the way, that I'm not going to be able to do it all. And by the way, that's sort of like this. The starting concept of to-do lists is, you can't ever do all the things you've got to do. That's the fundamental premise. You can't do it all. You cannot do everything that's on your list of things to do. You never will. You'll never be able to do it all. So what people who've learned how to manage time moderately successfully have learned is that they've got to distinguish between urgent and important things. That's how they manage their time. And if you don't learn to distinguish, then what you will do is you'll spend time in quadrant one dealing with urgent stuff, urgent stuff, urgent stuff, urgent stuff, urgent stuff, until you run away exhausted to quadrant four because you can't cope anymore. And if you spend the rest of your life doing that, you won't make a lot of progress, because you've got the same amount of time as everyone else, and unfortunately you're not going to be given any more time to ever get to the other stuff. Here's the next thing. You need to decide on the one item that will have the greatest consequences on your to-do list. So you look at your to-do list for the day and you say, okay, I've got 20 things to do today, that's interesting. Of those 20 items, what's the one item that's going to have the greatest consequences on? Now here's the big question, on what? What do you think?
Goals.
Ultimately the question is, on my goals. What one item will have the greatest consequence on moving my goals forward?
So what happens is most people in life have no goals written down, spend most of their life dealing in the urgent category, and there was a very famous saying about goals that was this. If people have no goals of their own, they're doomed to spend their life fulfilling someone else's. It's an interesting thought, isn't it? If people have no goals of their own, they're doomed to spend their life fulfilling someone else's. If you've got your goals clear, you can now answer this question intelligently on your to-do list. What's the one item that's going to have the greatest consequences? To what? To my goals. Now, bear in mind that for us, some of those goals could be spiritual as well. In a work context, though, you've got to see this in a work context. What one item is going to have the greatest consequence on my job and my business? Well, that item now has now got to come to the top of the list. All right? You decide it by a number of things. Could be the economic consequence, you know, or whatever, depending on whether you're talking about personal goals or family goals, or in this case, work goals. You would certainly assess it from the work perspective. You need to use the Pareto principle to determine importance. Who was Pareto? Yeah, when did he live and where is he from? Well done, okay. Now what did Pareto say? Do you know the Pareto principle? What Pareto said is that there's a paradox in life that 80% of the results come from 20% of the inputs. And if that's an interesting statistic, the inverse is even more interesting. That 20% of the results come from 80% of the inputs. So apply it in my job. I'm a financial advisor. What the Pareto principle means is that 80% of my income will come from 20% of my clients. And 20% of my income will come from 80% of my clients. Now, what would that teach me to do as a financial advisor? I need to focus on the 20% that produce 80% of my revenue, and I also need to focus on finding another set of clients similar to the 20% that already produce 80% of my revenue. And what should I probably start doing with the 80% of the clients that produce 20% of my revenue but gobble up 80% of my time and cause 80% of my problems? I need to actually fire my clients. Now, this happens with your to-do list as well. If you have a really good look at your to-do list, so, by the way, this works in everything in life. 80% of your restaurant experiences will be in 20% of the restaurants you know about. Think about where you go. You'll go to certain places most of the time. So those 20% of the restaurants get 80% of your revenue out of your total restaurant revenue. So the 80-20 rule works in every aspect of life. 80% of the results in any aspect of life come from only 20% of what was put in to achieve it. So you better try and figure out that 20%, because that 20% is clearly the most valuable, isn't it? By the way, it doesn't seem to work with Bible study. I've never been able to figure out which was the 20% that produced 80% of the results. I think you've got to put 100% in all the time. So, but from a time management point of view, the Pareto principle is really helpful because it forces you to have a really close look and say, is this on the 80% or the 20% side of the ledger? So before I fill up my to-do list with all the stuff that's only going to produce 20% of my results, I probably need to think about focusing on the other stuff that's going to produce 80% of my income or 80% of my results. And having decided on that, sorry, do you have a question, Jimmy?
Yeah, good question. When you do your to-do list, do you actually categorize them in four boxes as you put them on your list?
When you say categorize them, okay, I'll come back to categorizing in a minute. Yep, I'll mention that. In fact, I think I might have forgotten to put something down about categorizing, but we'll put it now. Procrastinate on the 80%. If you've decided that 80% of what's on your to-do list achieves 20% of your results, then delay those things. Procrastinate on them. creatively progress. You know, I've actually started to do that. I had this rule, and maybe it's the sort of, I guess it's in a sense an ethic of the truth. You think, I've got to do everything. And so you get all these stupid emails from stupid people on stupid things that they didn't need to send you. What they did is they sent an email to Johnny and thought, well, while I've sent one to Johnny, why don't I send it to my whole address book? And so 100 other people waste their time on the same stupid email that they didn't need to get. And you think, well, I need to look at this and respond and think about it and so on. Is it all part of the 80% of wasted time under the Pareto principle? Well, then there might be some things that you can creatively procrastinate on. And you know what happens when you do? Guess what happens to most of that stuff if you procrastinate? It goes away. It actually goes away. And you see, you're not able to do it all. This is where you've got to start with. I can't do it all. I actually cannot do it all. So if there's some stuff that I can't do, all I need to make sure is that it falls under the Pareto principle of the 80% that I probably shouldn't be doing anyway. So what I'll do is I'll just delay it. I won't say that I won't do it, but I'll just delay it. And as you do, stuff just starts dropping off the end because it actually wasn't important anyway. And many's the time when I've done something where I've looked at something and thought, oh boy, I don't know, this is, and I've worked and worked to do something to answer a person, and you go back and say, oh, that's all right, I've figured it out anyway, or I've done anything, or it doesn't matter now, but thanks anyway. So, let me just talk about categorising, Jimmy, because I don't think I've got this down here, and I think you're absolutely right, it needs to be down. So, let me add another one in now about categorisation. I use the A, B, C, D, E rule. Okay, so A, B, C, D, E is nice and simple, and if you haven't heard of the A, B, C, D, E rule, it goes like this. A, B, C are the categories under the Pareto principle of your actual to-do list items. So is it an A item? That means it's top of the list. Is it a B item? Is it a C item? Those are the three letters you use to categorize importance, order of importance. A items are top of the list in terms of importance. And if you've got three items, then you have A1, A2, A3. All right? So A1, A2, A3, B1, B2, B3, B4, B5, C1, C2. So ABCs is your categorization of items that have to be ranked in terms of some degree of importance and priority. So you've prioritized your items. Category D is delegate. Can I delegate this to someone else? Now, I've really struggled with this. I'm the sort of person that says, oh yeah, I'll do that, I can take care of that. And I struggle to delegate it to somebody else. But you actually have to learn to delegate it. And how you will best learn to delegate it is if you've got a clear set of goals that you're aiming to achieve and a to-do list that's linked to those goals, you will start to see now with more clarity that I've got to be careful here about how much time I spend on this. Can I delegate this to somebody else? Can I delegate this in my business to somebody else? Can I delegate this in the ecclesia to someone else? Is it really me that should be doing this? I know I'd like to. I know that's the spirit of the truth. But if I already can't achieve my other responsibilities in the truth, could I delegate this? Could we involve someone else in the meeting who's not doing as much, who may be able to do this? So D is delegate. E, eliminate. Eliminate means you trash it. It shouldn't be on the list. Someone's put it there for you, but it's actually, you need to get rid of it. So A, B, C, D, E. And if there's an F, F stands for file. It's done, it's filed. So that's the sort of category, sort of route that I travel down. There's all sorts of different methodologies. I just happen to have a passion for order and I like the idea of A, B, C, D, E. And so I follow that rule, okay? Learn how to set posteriorities. Now, everyone knows what a priority is. What's a posteriority? A posteriority is all the things you've got to decide not to do. Christadelphians really struggle to compile what not to do lists. They've got very full to-do lists and very skinny not-to-do lists. I think it's helpful to actually set posteriorities about what you won't do. In other words, what this is saying is, and by the way, I've done this just recently in terms of the truth, I've made a decision that there are certain things that I'm not going to do. Because I already feel that I'm beyond the limits of what I'm coping with now, spiritually and ecclesially and personally, and already there are some things that I don't feel that I can accomplish, and that by eliminating those and asking to be able to step aside from them, I will be able to better accomplish the things that I really do believe are the priorities spiritually that I've set in terms of what I think is the wisest use of my time. So learning how to set posteriorities mean that when people come to you and say, can you do this, or could you be involved in this, or could you join this committee, or could you do this, you might have to say, look, I'd love to do that, and I thank you very much for the opportunity, but I think the answer needs to be no, because I think that compromises my ability to do what I've already set down to achieve in the Lord's service, and I don't think that I can take that task on, so the answer's no. Christadelphians find it hard to say no. But sometimes you have to do that if you're going to manage your time prudently. Learning how to set posteriorities. Don't clear up small things first. Worst first is the rule. So what happens is, people arrive in the morning with their to-do list. There's a whole raft of things to do. They fail to do the A, B, C, D thing, Jimmy, and so they haven't categorized them. So there's just 20 things. They think, oh, boy, this is a disaster. Well, there's two or three little things here. I might tidy some of those up first. I'll get those out of the way. Wrong. Wrong, 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 wrong. What you've got to do is the hardest, most difficult, most important thing first. So you bring that to the top of the list and you say, that's A1. The small stuff will take care of itself in due course. But don't ever make the mistake of going to the small end of the list. Remember what we've decided earlier back here. What's really important? What's the big ticket items? Well, when you arrive to start in the morning on that to-do list, you start with that number one item, A1. Straight onto it. Absolutely straight onto it and straight on focus. What's the most valuable use of my time right now? I found that a very helpful question. Because when you're self-employed, you're accountable to no one. That's a great danger. So one of the things that I do to try and keep myself on task is to ask that question every morning. Okay, here it is. I've got my to-do list, got my computer, got everything here, got my emails. Right, what's the most valuable use of my time right now? Okay, I think it is to tackle my to-do list, this item here. Ugh, that looks awful. What's the most valuable use of my time right now? That item. Okay, get the file out, get on with it. And just repeating that and asking yourself that, and basically what's that? Of course, what that is really saying is this: isn't this a recognition of the reality of Ecclesiastes? If time is finite, I better figure out the most valuable use. Last item: use single handling until the current task is 100% complete. What single handling means is that if you've decided on the top item, you clear your desk of absolutely everything, you bring the one file, the one task, the one document, the one letter out that you're dealing with, A1, you put it on the table and you work on it single-mindedly until it's done. Then you cross it off the to-do list, you put that file away, you say, what's A2? A2 is to review the Smith file, you get the Smith file out on your desk and you work on it, and you don't stop handling the Smith file until it's finished 100%, then you put it away. Single handling. What people do is they scatter stuff all over their desk and they say, I better do that. What was that? Oh, that's an interesting document. Where's that? I must remember to do that as well. Now, what was that I was looking at? And they go round and round all over the place and they double, triple, multiple handle pieces of paper. Waste of time. Single handling. Run it off your to-do list, be absolutely focused, and stay with that to-do list item until it's completed. So these are practical things that I use in my daily life and in my spiritual life, which I find very helpful in terms of managing time effectively. And that is, in fact, the end of our time because the tape's run out. Len.
The interesting thing about the lists are there's a great satisfaction
huge.
Man, does that make all the difference in the world?
Huge. Absolutely huge. Because it does. You get a real, I mean, I don't like the word buzz, but you know what I mean. You get a real buzz every time you do it. I use a red pen and I go, you know, yes. Right, what's the next thing? Because you do, you feel a sense of accomplishment. You feel a sense of progress. You feel that you've achieved something and that you've done it well, you've focused and you've crossed it off. And you know, one of the surprising things about things, have you ever had something that you think, oh man, I've got to do this, and you put it off, you put it off, you put it off, you put it off, and in the end, it gets unbearably bad, you think, I've got to do this, and so you think, bah! So you do it, and you think, what did I delay that for? Yes, it did require some focus, but you know, so...
The other thing I've started doing because I got older, I started doing this because I got older. But the other thing I do is I use 3 colored markers now, and that's my priority. So I know that there's things I have to do, there's things I need to do, and there's those things that I
would like to do. Yeah. Okay, so you color code.
Look at it and say,
okay, that's good.
I got to deal with these colored things here.
So you use a color code. All right, so what we're saying here is that there are different ways of coding. You could code numerically or alpha sequence like A, B, C, D, E, F. Or you could use colors if you're a color person and you enjoy having various colored pens. So any questions with regard to what we've put up so far? Actually, that's not really quite right, what we've put up, because there's nothing beyond that so far as the end. Any other questions with regard to time? Now, what I haven't talked about is setting spiritual priorities in that context. And the reason why I haven't talked about that is because I do think that this is something you've got to do privately and personally. You've got to now set your spiritual priorities. But what I do think is that they've got to be considered within the context of time management and how it integrates with the rest of your life. I think Christadelphians have got to learn how to integrate. More than any other people, they've got to learn how to integrate their personal life, their business life, their family life, their ecclesial life, their spiritual life, and that's quite complicated. So we have to have good time management skills. And good time management skills is just the latest worldly lingo for what the Apostle Paul said all along, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Buy it up as much as you can because otherwise it's gone for good. So I come back to that goal-setting exercise. I believe the reason why those Harvard graduates were more successful is not because they were more talented, but simply because they used their time better. But what was the key thing that helped them use their time better? They had to-do lists, but they had goals. They had very clear goals. And my personal belief is this, in any organization, give me an ordinary person with no tertiary qualifications but very clear goals written down, and give me a doctorate person with no goals in life, and I'll tell you now that this person will run rings around them. They will. So it's all about focus, really, isn't it? Gaining clarity of focus. Now, to me, that phrase, clarity of focus, is exactly how we should be in the truth. Don't we need clarity of focus in the truth? Clarity of what we're trying to do, what we're trying to achieve? Think about this in terms of your spiritual and ecclesial goals. So you've got to think big here. You've got to set... By the way, there is a concept about goals. This is out of another management book called either From Good to Great or Built to Last. Anyone heard of those two books? They were written by... Jim Collins and Jerry Porras in the case of Built to Last. Now, these are management experts, and in the book Built to Last, what they did is they analysed 20 of the top companies to decide what made them good, what made them special. And what they found is they always had these fundamental core values that stood at the heart of the organisation. I've lost the track of what I was going to say there. Why was I mentioning that? Let me just go back one step. What did I say immediately before?
Saying that if we have core values, then we'll be stronger and built.
Oh,
I think probably just, I don't think this was the thing, but it will suffice, is having clarity of focus is critical. And when companies had their core values written down, it gave them a clarity of focus above and beyond other companies. So what happened is they analysed these companies and they said, have you got any core values? And some of them did and some of them didn't. What they found, and the interesting thing about this study in Built to Last, is they tracked these companies for 100 years. 100 years! They tracked them for a century. And one of the reasons why they tracked them for a century was to make absolutely sure that it didn't relate to the charismatic leadership of any one chief executive. So these are companies that had chief executive after chief executive after chief, and it was still the number one company in their respective business globally. And they found that the critical ingredient that made them different was that they had core values as their own in-house goals that they passionately believed in. And by the way, none of those goals had anything to do with making money. Their goals were about the intrinsic value of their enterprise and what that enterprise contributed to the community. Those companies became the leaders in their respective fields because they had clear, absolutely clear goals, and that clarity of focus filtered from the chief executive right down through the organization. And in the course of 100 years, they constantly reinvented themselves, constantly were dynamic, and were at the top of their field. Because the other companies, despite the fact that many of them were big, didn't have any goals. So clarity of focus is really critical. And I think if you think about this now in the context of ecclesial life, I've remembered now what it was. So one of the words that Jim Collins uses in that book is, and this he's talking about companies, is you need to have BHAGs. And I don't really like this expression, but I'll mention it. And a BHAG is an acronym for Big, Hairy, Audacious Goals. That's what he calls them. You need to have big, hairy, audacious goals. And one of the things they say about goal setting is that when you set a goal, it needs to have about a 50% probability level of being achievable. If you set a goal that's 80% achievable, how does that impact on your movement towards that goal? It's slower because you think, well, it's in the bag anyway. If you set a goal that's 20% achievable, how does that impact? You feel depressed and discouraged because you've set goals that you can't get there. You can't make it. You've set goals that are too high. If you set a goal that's big and audacious, but with about a 50% probability that it might be achievable, what happens? You think, right, let's get cracking. Where's my to-do list? I'm going to push this right to the top. Nope, sorry about everything else. Number one. Because it's possible, just possible, that I might be able to achieve this. So goals have got to be big enough to excite you. So when you think about the truth, don't have a focus that simply says, I would like to study Ephesians, I want to develop prayer in my life. I'm not saying that all those things are wrong, but what about the community you belong to? What about the ecclesia? What about the Christianization of the truth? What about some of these other big issues that might rent the brotherhood asunder in the future? What do you think should be done to guard against that, to protect against that? What are the big goals that you have in mind on focus in terms of the community worldwide that it's under challenge for that you want to do something about? Have you got any of those goals? Or are you so narrow in your focus that you only ever think about yourself? So you've got to have your goals, family goals, ecclesial goals, brotherhood goals. And they need to be big enough and audacious enough to excite you as to the fact that these are things you would like to be involved in if Yahweh permit and if Yahweh provide the opportunity. Because only Yahweh will provide the time for those. You don't even know whether all of that will be outworked. But if you've got objectives, you'll be ready for them. Do you know that there was an interesting there's an interesting place you can go to in South Africa where they show you the house of Nelson Mandela? And in one room there's a pair of shoes. And a person was visiting, I think, from America, this place, that Nelson Mandela's house in South Africa, and he examined this pair of shoes. And he said, you know, the wear on these shoes is remarkable because they're a pair of like sort of running shoes or sneakers. But he said, this is not the wear of running. I can deduce from the wear of the shoes that this person has run on the spot. They've run in a stationary position. And Nelson Mandela said, yes, those are my prison shoes from when I was on Robben's Island. How long was he incarcerated for? Over 20 years? Was it about 20 years? Something like that, wasn't it? It was a very long period of time, 15 to 20 years. And these running shoes, he said, the reason why they're marked that way is because I ran in my cell against the wall. So he stood in front of the wall and he simply ran in a stationary position. He ran and he ran and he ran and he ran for years in a prison cell. And they said, why did you do that? He said, because I believed that I was needed for South Africa and that one day I would be used, and I had to keep my health up, had to stay fit. So I ran in my cell. You think that man had goals? He had burning goals, audacious goals. Here's a man that was in prison for years, but he ran the footsoles off his shoes because he believed in a goal that would need him later on, for which he would need all his energies and all his physical strength. So he knew he had to keep his physical strength at the premium, even in prison. So that's the power of goals, the power of clarity of focus. Imagine if we could apply that to the truth, in terms of our goals in the truth, personally, ecclesially, community. So I think there's a lot to do here. A lot to do here. And so that's why I run two to-do lists, because you can't... I've got to have a to-do list for my daily job, and I have to have a to-do list for my ecclesial and family and spiritual and personal objectives. And the trouble is that that list is sometimes bigger than my work list for work, and so I'm juggling two lists and two diaries and two computers. But it's great. It's the only way to do it. And if I didn't do that, I'd be in a state of chaos. And what does that chaos lead to? Such pressure that in the end, you don't achieve anything. And I don't think that that's honouring to God, that we get ourselves into such chaos that we don't achieve anything. Yes?
I mean, really, to sum it up,
in essence, that's right. I won't go into it, but by the way, I don't think that verse means anything like that in terms of how we use it, but that's another story. If you go back and look at the contextual setting of the verse, you'll find that it actually means something else. But I think that biblical idea is correct, is that we've got to have vision and clarity of vision as to where we're heading. Absolutely right. So, yeah, any other questions? Okay, well, I think we'll close at that point and break for morning tea.
Yep, 11 o'clock, we'll start up again.
That's good.